Good afternoon, folks, and welcome. It's time to break free. I'll be your host for the hour, David Matthew Rock, coming to you live from the constitutional carry state of Arizona via the Patriot broadcast from the trenches, 89.5 FM, Chiloquin, the state of Jefferson. Simulcast on IndianaFreedomTalkRadio.com, the Grow Your Own channel, 107.5 FM, Greenville, South Carolina, Hal Apino's channel, 87.9 FM, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and many more micro-broadcasts and webcasts heard around the world. Take the time to check out the number one source for Patriot news on the web at FromTheTrenchesWorldReport.com. If you'd like to contact me via email, I can be reached at DavidMatthewRock@gmail.com. This is a live call-in program. Come on up and share your thoughts and experiences. Unlike the mainstream media, listener participation is appreciated. The call-in number is 641-715-3610. Once connected, you'll be asked for the conference room number, which is 220029 in the pound sign. Hit star 6 to unmute. It is 1:02 p.m. Arizona Mountain Time. It's 102 degrees in Casa Grande, Arizona, sunny with 12% humidity, and my backyard's crawling with caterpillars. They're like 4 inches long and green. Anyway, there is so much negative press on the Red Cross as of late that the Bleeding Rectum NPR whores published what I would call a damage control piece interviewing Red Cross executive Brad Kaiserman. Kaiserman, who had been elevated to the head of FEMA's National Flood Insurance Program in early 2015, announced he was departing for an executive position with the Red Cross on June 13th, the same year, just 24 hours before Kaiserman was set to testify during a congressional hearing into allegations of systematic flood insurance fraud in the weeks and months after Superstorm Sandy. We will get into it as soon as we return from these messages from our sponsors. You take a mortal man and put him in control. Watch him become a god.
Hey, old Dr. Bones here. Are you prepared to deal with medical issues in a disaster situation? What would you do if medical help was not on the way? The Doom and Bloom Survival Medicine Handbook is over 400 pages of how-to advice written in plain English. You'll learn to handle all the likely medical issues you'll encounter in times of trouble. And it's not just the conventional medical wisdom. We talk about alternatives like essential oils, medicinal herbs, and other home remedies. Make the Doom and Bloom Survival Medicine Handbook a part of your survival library. And don't forget, Nurse Amy and I have medical kits, suture materials, instructional DVDs, and other items that'll help you keep it together even if things fall apart. Check them out, as well as 200 articles on medical preparedness, survival gardening, and other alternative remedies on our website at www.doomandbloom.net. Never think doom and gloom, think doom and bloom.
Divergent Flavor Labs introduces our all-original e-juice flavor line made from pure 100% kosher USP food-grade ingredients. Whether it's our flavored tobaccos like Calypso or our amazing bakery flavors like Creme de Liumptious, Divergent Flavor Labs' handmade all-original flavor line will never disappoint. Available exclusively through VaporRebellion.com.
Thank you for listening to PBFTT.
Patriot Broadcast from the Trenches, 89.5.
Micro FM.
Chiloquin,
the state of Jefferson.
It's time to break free, live on PBFTT, August 31st, 2017. I'm your host, David Matthew Rock. Thank you for joining me this afternoon. All right, before we get into this whole Red Cross thing, I wanted to pick up on the conversation going on last hour. They were discussing the home problem in Orange County, California. So, yeah, last night I was sitting around my kitchen table chatting with my next-door neighbor, and he was telling me that his family members had sent him some pictures, and he actually brought it up to me. So I was surprised to see it in the news today. That's why I went ahead and sent it in right away. But anyway, here's my solution to the problem, right? Get rid of all the taxation, regulation, and coercion, and let's see what happens when survival of the fittest really comes into play. We got such a huge system, a vampiric system sitting over the top of us, sucking our freaking wealth dry, and then using police to coerce us to the point where our children can't even do a lemonade stand, right? So let's get rid of all these tiers of absolute bullshit and get back to survival of the fittest. You don't work, you don't participate, you don't get shit.
Bullshit.
That's what's going to fix everything. Anything else is some form of socialism, communism, fascism. I don't care what kind of ism it is. Just leave everybody alone and leave them to their own devices. Then they'll have two options. They either sink or swim.
They're training our kids to the point of where, if, you know, they don't know what it's like to do a hard day's worth of work. They don't know what it's like to sit there and sweat their ass off and pour concrete or do, you know, put in floor joists or some shit. You know, I really hate to go driving into town. It's a 70-mile drive for me, and I go and I look at these freaking kids nowadays.
I got a solution for you.
Okay.
I have a solution. This is how, okay, make me dictator tomorrow. Not that I would want to be, but this is how I would conduct education. 4 years, reading, writing, arithmetic, history. That's it. You start at age 8, you're done at age 12. At age 12, you move on to your apprenticeship, whatever that may be. Every young boy wants to work. By the time they're a teenage boy, they don't want to work no more. They want to chase after girls and smoke weed. So I'm of the opinion.
There you go.
Yeah, reading, writing, arithmetic, history, 4 years, start your apprenticeship.
Yep.
Yep.
I used to actually be able to write in cursive, you know, after I had it beaten into me by the goddamn Roman Catholic Church, you know.
Yeah, my mom went to Catholic Church. I actually got kicked out of Catholic school. My mom went to Catholic school. I got kicked out of Catholic school after completing kindergarten. They just didn't mix. Me and Catholicism didn't mix very well. But why I got you here, Flea, I wanted to read one of your comments. You were commenting.
No.
Yes.
Don't expose me.
Oh, come on.
I'm exposed right now. I got my underwear on. Don't do it.
You commented on the article, unconcerned about Trump's militarizing of police. This database shows what the local cops have. So Flea said on August 31st, he's like, I love the police. In fact, this Halloween, I'm going to go trick-or-treat in a cop costume. I'll knock on your door, point a gun at you, and say, give me your fucking candy. Then I'll pistol whip you and steal your Xbox. I got a kick out of that. I don't know. I just brought it up, wanted to read it. So anyway,
you're killing me.
Just wait till tomorrow. I'm going to read another one of your comments. Anyway, so we got this clip coming from NPR, and I want to play it real quick. I'll call it a damage control piece. That's what it seems like to me, because as soon as I put in this Brad Keiserman's name into DuckDuckGo, not Google, as soon as I put his name into DuckDuckGo, I pulled up another article showing that he's tied to fraud with the Superstorm Sandy, and then he was in a high-up position at FEMA dealing with the National Flood Insurance Program, which I just think, isn't that really convenient? You know, this guy's got, is being looked at for fraud with flood insurance, and then all of a sudden we got a big flood in freaking Houston. I mean, I'm not trying to tie the two together, but maybe I am. All right, so we're going to play this clip from the bleeding rectums, the whores of NPR.
And people across the country, they do want to help, so they're opening up their wallets. The American Red Cross is one of the best-known aid groups, but that organization has come under a lot of scrutiny after investigations by NPR and ProPublica and by Congress. Huge administrative costs and a failure to deliver in recent natural disasters were among the problems reported. We reached Red Cross executive Brad Kaiserman on Skype to talk about all this. He's vice president of disaster operations and logistics. Kaiserman says his organization has so far spent $50 million on Harvey relief.
We've got enough shelter supplies today in theater for over 66,000 people. I put more shelter supplies downrange.
How many shelters is that for 60,000 people?
So on Tuesday evening going into Wednesday morning, we had 232 shelters throughout the state.
So in the past, during Hurricane Isaac in 2012, the Red Cross had some issues getting supplies to the disaster. You had trucks driving around empty, purely for PR purposes. Is that happening now?
Not on my watch, Elsa. That's not going to happen. And if it does, I'm going to deal with that. We are a relief organization. For many, many people, the Red Cross is an iconic organization, and I think it's important that they see the hope that it brings. But there's a difference between people seeing hope and actually using resources in a way that helps them.
Exactly.
And we are committed. I am committed. My team is committed to using our resources and donor dollars in a way that best helps the people of Texas.
What is the Red Cross doing differently this time around to make sure that we don't see Red Cross truck drivers driving around empty trucks? How better are you monitoring these drivers? Or how better are you recalibrating your PR campaign so that resources aren't deployed for PR and are actually being deployed to deliver relief?
So one, in terms of our ability to monitor our emergency response vehicle, all of those vehicles are now geocoded. So I'm actually sitting in my operations center here in Fairfax, Virginia, and I can look and tell you where every IRV is, where every emergency response vehicle has been. I can tell you how fast it's going and where it's going next.
So you can monitor 300 vehicles simultaneously going around these flood areas and all the supplies in them.
I can't tell you where every meal has gone. I can tell you where every load of meals has gone. And I can tell you where the truckloads were delivered when they came in by tractor trailer. And then I can tell you how they were distributed through either emergency response vehicles or fixed sites. So I think we have a much better audit trail to show. And that, of course, allows us to make sure we're better stewards of those resources.
But I just want to be very clear. I mean, you are acknowledging that during Hurricane Isaac, there were empty trucks being driven around for PR purposes?
I wasn't here during Hurricane Isaac.
But
I'm trying to remember
which. Do you have knowledge of what happened before you arrived?
I do. I have knowledge of what happened before I arrived. And so I would say this. I've read the reports, and I'll tell you why. If you do not learn from and acknowledge your mistakes, then you are never going to get better. All I know is it was reported. The fact that somebody thinks it happened, the fact that it may indeed have happened, that is a good enough reason for me as a leader and for my team to make improvements in the system and to pay attention to those issues.
I want to talk about donations now. The Red Cross has stated in the past that more than 90 cents on every dollar that it receives through donations goes towards relief. But our reporting and an investigation by Congress show that a quarter of the donations for Haiti, for example, went to internal spending on management and oversight. And last year, Republican Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa stated that he had substantial concerns about the Red Cross. So now, how much of every dollar that the Red Cross raises, how much of that is going directly to relief? Can you answer that question?
On the average, 91 cents of every dollar that we spend is invested. That we spend.
So I'm asking a different question. How much of every dollar that you receive through donations, how much of every dollar donated goes to relief?
Yeah, I don't think I know the answer to that any better than the chief fundraiser knows how many emergency response vehicles I have on the road today. So I think if he was on this interview and you were asking him how many relief vehicles were in Texas, I don't think he'd know the answer. And I don't know the answer to the financial question, I'm afraid.
I want to return to Haiti. Our reporting showed that 25% of the money donated for Haiti to the American Red Cross went to internal spending. Is that still happening? Such a substantial proportion of donations going to internal administrative costs rather than to relief?
It's not something I would have any visibility on. I can talk about what it costs to deliver certain relief services, but
yeah.
the way in which the internal revenue stream works,
you don't know what proportion of that amount.
No, I really
you don't know
don't.
What proportion of the total amount is that relief.
No, I really don't. I wish I could answer your question, but it's not something that I have visibility on in the role that I play in this organization.
Well, do you have visibility on any efforts the organization is making to reduce the amount of money being spent solely on internal costs?
That I have visibility on, because I can tell you
okay.
that the folks that I work for are very, very attentive to cost effectiveness and cost efficiencies and making sure that as much of every dollar that we spend on an operation is client facing. You know, we call the people we serve clients.
So given the well-documented problems with the Red Cross, tell me what has changed.
One of the first things we did when it became clear that we had issues to address was to do a root cause analysis and to say, so why are these things happening? Why is it being reported that trucks are driving around as public affairs marketing boards as opposed to actually providing assistance? And what you learn is that as long as your folks who are delivering assistance understand why, then you can prevent those kind of potentially well-intentioned actions from happening.
All right. Brad Kaiserman is Vice President of Disaster Operations and Logistics for the American Red Cross. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Elsa, and thanks to everybody winding down. Right.
Brad Kaiserman, everybody. And what I find most laughable about that is listening to NPR pretending to be legitimate journalists. You know, to me, that sounded like damage control. It sounded completely scripted and managed and fake. So anyway, when I looked up this individual's name, I found an article. It's on FromTheTrenchesWorldReport.com. It's titled, FEMA Losing Head of Sandy Insurance Fraud Probe. It was published June 2nd, 2015. All right, let's get into it. Brad Kaiserman, the point person for the Federal Emergency Management Agency's investigation into allegations that Superstorm Sandy homeowners were cheated by their flood insurers, is stepping down. Kaiserman, who had been elevated to head of FEMA National Flood Insurance Program earlier this year, is departing for an executive position with the Red Cross. A FEMA spokeswoman confirmed the impending exit to the Asbury Park Press. It was first reported by Newsday. Kaiserman's last day will be June 13th. The news broke. Go ahead.
Stop it. You're killing me. Yeah, I got a Red Cross for you. It's right on my ass.
Well, I mean, I've heard people say that they might have a Knights Templar Association and that they're a worldwide institution and probably Freemasonic to one degree. So, yeah, they're a bunch of lying.
Oh, Masons don't exist. Just keep voting.
All right. Well, all right, Flea, I got to finish this article. Let me continue. The news broke less than 24 hours before Kaiserman was to testify during a congressional hearing into allegations of systematic flood insurance fraud in the weeks after weeks and months after Sandy. FEMA government insurers let down by Sandy victims. His resignation also follows FEMA's first release of figures on the Kaiserman-led Sandy claims review process, which in the first 10 days of the program fielded 800 requests for reviews from homeowners. Of those 800, 530 were found to be eligible for a second look. In the months after Sandy, Jersey Shore homeowners frequently complained about what they perceived to be lowball payouts from their flood insurance providers, but FEMA wasn't prompted to address those complaints until evidence emerged of a politically widespread fraud involving key reports that serve as the foundation for whether a structural claim is approved or denied. Part of the agency's response was to develop an all-encompassing claims review process. Okay, we don't have to get into too many details here. But anyway, so that there's if you want to look into it yourself, it's at FromTheTrenchesWorldReport.com. So this individual that you just heard that was doing damage control for the Red Cross was tied into insurance fraud with FEMA on flood insurance relative to the Superstorm Sandy. So this next article I got lined up is coming from the New York Slime, New York Times. It's posted at FromTheTrenchesWorldReport.com for discussion. It was published on August 30th. It's titled, Houston Curfew Follows Many in Big Cities Facing Disaster or Unrest. We had some similar articles up yesterday, but this one had some historical information in it. So let's get into it. The mayor of Houston imposed a curfew in his city on Tuesday, ordering nearly everyone off the streets from midnight to 5 a.m. in an effort to stop small-scale looting and other crimes following flooding from Tropical Storm Harvey. Houston has a population of 2.3 million people spread across nearly 670 square miles, making the curfew among the largest and most expansive in the United States history. Go ahead, Flea.
You're killing me, man. Hey, well, I got a curfew for you. Stay away from my Home Depot crap bucket when I take a dump.
Well, hold on a second. Go ahead,
who's
Mark.
Who's enforcing this curfew? Who's enforcing this curfew? A National Guard or Black Coats? I mean, and they're using the word curfew. Bullshit. It's martial law.
Exactly. And let's look at it this way. If you're going to push everybody off the streets at gunpoint, then you're creating a situation where there's a vacuum. Anywhere the police are not, there's potentially nobody outside, okay? And that means it's easier to start breaking into homes and breaking into stores. There's no way you could cover 670 square miles, could you? So if everybody is mandatorily stuck inside of their houses, that means they're not defending their vehicles, their businesses, or their neighbor's home. Now, are they? So to me, this would be 180 degrees from what you would actually want. You would want the militia, the people, to defend their neighborhoods and their homes, just like we saw with the Koreans in the LA riots. What did they do? They defended their businesses with rifles because the National Guard and the police simply stood down. So this is 180 degrees from what we should be doing in America. And this article goes through the history.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They just sent 30,000 National Guard into Texas. I mean, the commanders of this National Guard need to go talk to the commander of the local militia and have a little powwow. Like, I guard this block, you guard that block. I mean, make it a community. I mean, you know, this is so much bullshit. I the people have got, the militia's got to stand up and say, fuck you. We're going to be doing this with you.
Well,
I mean, period.
Mark, settle down. All right, take a deep breath. I have a solution. What we do is we mount all the coyotes with webcams that report to Instagram, and we can see in real time what the hell's going on.
Well, so I want to make a point. I want to make a point. We don't need a highly structured, highly organized militia. And when I say militia, I don't mean like a specific militia. I just mean the body of the people who own the homes, who live in the neighborhoods, who own the businesses, who have an actual interest in preserving their stuff, are the ones that should be taking care of this. They're the ones that are going to fight the hardest to keep their stuff. And if you got the more eyeballs on the street you have, and the more armed people on the street you have, people aren't even going to think about raiding nothing. You know, let's just say, for instance, one or two people stayed behind per street. You know, those one or two people can secure that whole street. They could do way better job than the National Guard and the police could ever do. And think logistically, why would you want to drag people from all around the country and bring them to where the problem is when the people who are there can handle it?
Let's start with calling this what it really is, martial law. Let's at least agree to start with that term, and we'll just go from there. I mean, curfew is what happens when, you get caught going out your window to go see your girlfriend when you're 13 years old, your dad kicks your ass and gives you a curfew for the next fucking month. That's curfew.
I'll tell you what, I want to continue on this article, and every time the word curfew comes up, I will replace it with martial law just for you. Fair enough? All right.
Fair enough.
Let me continue, please. Hold on. I might have lost it real quick. All right, did you guys have any other...
It's 1:25. You still got 5 minutes, man.
Well, no, I got to do work offline mode because the way that my radio show broadcasts, I don't want to interrupt my signal in any way because it tends to drop on Henry's end, but I just hit the wrong button for some reason. I lost the page, but actually I just got it back up, so let me see where I was. Okay, so 1992, riots in Los Angeles. The acquittal of four Los Angeles police officers on April 29th, 1992, in the vicious beating of Rodney King, a black motorist, blah, 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 promoted widespread looting, relentless violence, and arson in the city. Hundreds of fires burned throughout the city. Firefighters racing to extinguish them were shot at, and looters snatched merchandise from stores. Seeing no signs to conditions improving, Mayor Tom Bradley imposed a dusk-to-dawn martial law in the worst parts of the city on April 30th, but soon expanded it to all of Los Angeles, which then had a population of more than 3.4 million. National Guard troops were brought in to help enforce the martial law. Guard members were placed across the city, including near Koreatown, the heart of some of the worst rioting. There is no way the police can arrest everybody on the street, Mr. Bradley, discussing the martial law, told the Los Angeles Times. What we are really looking for here is voluntary compliance. Now, does that term sound familiar? Voluntary compliance? It's actually what was in the IRS code now, isn't it? The martial law worked, contributing to a sharp decline in violence and looting, and Mr. Bradley lifted the martial law on May 3rd. Now, like I said, if the people in the community just defended their community, problem solved. You know what I mean? And that proved true in some areas of Koreatown. You can go on YouTube, unless it's been made to disappear, and you can see the gentlemen standing on their roofs with their rifles, keeping the looters at bay. And they didn't even go into a mass killing or anything like that. They were respectful enough of human life. They did what it took to preserve their property. The riots also spread to cities outside Los Angeles, including San Francisco, where the city issued its first state of emergency since the 1906 earthquake and imposed several days of nighttime martial law. That's probably a good idea to replace curfew with martial law. I like that. 1965, Watts riots in Los Angeles. 6 days of violence in the Watts section of Los Angeles started with a traffic stop on a warm afternoon on August 11th, 1965. Officer Lee W. Minicus, a white California Highway Patrol officer, spotted a swerving car in South Central Los Angeles, figured the driver was drunk, and pulled him over. With what transpired next is still not fully clear. Now, isn't that interesting? This kind of reminds me of the race riots in my home city. I was reading about last week or the week before. But officer...
Oh, wait.
Yeah,
you got to be making this up, man.
It's coming from the Jewish supremacist New York slime. So with all of these articles, you have to read between the lines. And I'll say that about all media. Go ahead.
I'm still worried about Rodney King and Reginald Denny.
Yeah, how so?
They're both dead.
Well, they're just showing a historical timeline, and they're trying to sell you on the ideas of curfews working. But I'll say it again. It's 180 degrees from how America should be. Americans protect America. Texans protect Texas. Houstonians protect Houstonians. And if you live on Orange Street, you're the protector of Orange Street. You need eyeballs. You need hands. You need guns. You need brains. And I don't see the point in dragging people halfway around the damn country and bringing them there. Logistically, it's retarded. We don't need Big Daddy government to come save us every time. In fact, I think it creates more problems when you have Big Daddy government because you're going to assume somebody's going to come save you. So it makes for a weak people. And with that said, we've reached our bottom of the hour break. We'll be back in about 8 minutes.
I'm taking the fight.
Old Dr. Bones here. Are you prepared to deal with medical issues in a disastrous situation? What would you do if medical help was not on the way? The Doom and Bloom Survival Medicine Handbook is over 400 pages of how-to advice written in plain English. You'll learn to handle all the likely medical issues you'll encounter in times of trouble. And it's not just the conventional medical wisdom. We talk about alternatives like essential oils, medicinal herbs, and other home remedies. Make the Doom and Bloom Survival Medicine Handbook a part of your survival library. And don't forget, Nurse Amy and I have medical kits, suture materials, instructional DVDs, and other items that'll help you keep it together even if things fall apart. Check them out, as well as 200 articles on medical preparedness, survival gardening, and other alternative remedies on our website at www.doomandbloom.net. Never think doom and gloom, think doom and bloom.
Divergent Flavor Labs introduces our all-original e-juice flavor line made from pure 100% kosher USP food-grade ingredients. Whether it's our flavored tobaccos like Calypso or our amazing bakery flavors like Crumbiliumptious, Divergent Flavor Labs' handmade all-original flavor line will never disappoint. Available exclusively through VaporsRebellion.com.
Thank you for listening to PBFTT.
Patriot Broadcast from the Trenches, 89.5.
Micro FM.
Chiloquin, the state of Jefferson.
It's Time to Break Free is a listener-sponsored broadcast. If you'd like to help keep this program on the air, go to FromTheTrenchesWorldReport.com and hit that donate button. Or you can mail donations to Henry Shively at Post Office Box 964, Chiloquin, Oregon 97624. Your contributions are appreciated. I'm your host, David Matthew Rock. It is 1:38 p.m. Arizona Mountain Time, and that was Prong with Divide and Conquer. That was actually sent to me by Rev, one of our listeners in Arizona. So hold on, I just want to unmute the call-in line. There we go. And let's get into this article a little deeper. Let's see where I left off. Okay, so what transpired was still not fully clear, but Officer Minicus and the driver of the car, Marquette Fry, a 21-year-old black man, were first seen joking. Then something happened, and rumors quickly spread in the neighborhood that Mr. Fry's mother, Then Mr. Fry's mother arrived and scolded her son for being drunk. And then she and her son were both beaten by the police. As the police took Mr. Fry away to jail, he said in an interview years later, he overheard a friend say, "Don't worry, we're going to burn this mother down." That's exactly what happened. Hold on. Got to scroll here. From August 11th to August 16th, riots erupted in Watts, a predominantly black neighborhood south of downtown, and spread to several dozen square miles of Los Angeles, which had a population of about 2.5 million. About 20,000 guard members were called in, and an additional 1,000 police officers were brought in to try to restore peace. As a chunk of Los Angeles turned into a war zone, snipers shot at police and fires raged. Well, wouldn't we like to see that again? I guess we got that bullshit event in Texas. I'm not convinced that that was legit. Was that Dallas? Anyway, it's a mess. Lieutenant General Roderick Hill of the California National Guard told the New York Times. The state issued a curfew starting at 8 p.m. on August 14th for a martial law for 46.5 square miles of Los Angeles, including Watts, which encompassed hundreds of thousands of people. In the end, 34 people died, including some law enforcement officers, and thousands were injured. More than 600 buildings were damaged. Well, you know what? If there's that many people... David? Yes, come on up.
Hi. May I talk about how my grandfather handled a problem that he had when his business was threatened?
Go ahead.
In 1938, my grandfather owned a business. It was a three-story brick building. He had his business on the first floor, another one on the second, and the third floor was empty. He had some small-time hood come in and demand protection money. And my grandfather said, "You got to be kidding me. There's no way I'm giving you money. Get the heck out of here." The guy left, came back the next day, and he said, "You better pay me money. I'm going to burn down your building." My grandfather just said to him, "Go right ahead. We'll be waiting for you." Some of the people who worked for him and his five sons went to the second floor and the third floor of the building and waited. My father was 12 years old. He was given a shotgun. I can't imagine some of the 12-year-olds I've seen nowadays. They're like six-year-olds. He was given a shotgun, and they protected the building. They stood watch for 3 days till the problem got taken care of. And when this man was in Sicily, the reason he came to America, we're not sure, family stories, you know how they can change, was either a bureaucrat or someone from the mafia threatened his father's business. He was the only one there. He took what was handy. He got really mad and stabbed the guy. I don't know if he killed him or just hurt him or whatever, but he was put on a boat, sent to America at 19 years old with $10 in his pocket. So that's how people handle things. You think my grandfather could have called those Irish policemen to help him? Are you kidding me? They would have laughed in his face. They probably would have helped the guy start the fire for him. So he handled it himself with his family and his friends his way. Too bad we're all not like that.
Yeah, I mean, the police are just a middleman. The National Guard is a middleman. You're asking somebody to come in and step in on your behalf and handle what you should be handling on your own. So one thing I think it's kind of interesting about what you're talking about, coming over here with $10 in your pocket and being able to start a business, is that in that period of time in New York, you could actually get a job somewhere, get a few dollars in your pocket, and start building your business because you simply didn't have what would I have in my notes? The taxation, regulation, and coercion that we're seeing today. You know, if we could get these go ahead.
There was coercion. When my grandfather came here, he got a job on the railroad, and his boss went to him on payday, first paycheck he got. He went to him and he said, "You want to keep your job? You got to give me X amount of money out of your pay. Otherwise, you're out of here." My grandfather said, "I left Sicily to get away from people like you. You can have your job." And he walked right off. You know, he was a tough old buzzard. He was, I would say, mean in a lot of ways, very strict. You know, he wasn't at all flexible. He was rigid. He had a lot of old world ideas and a lot of meanness in him, but boy, he was a man who lived by his word. And looking back, I have a lot of respect for many of the things he did.
I want to clarify a little bit. When I mean, okay, they had taxation at that period in time. They had regulation at that.
Not income tax.
I understand.
Not income tax.
I understand. Let me make my point. They had taxation. They had regulation. And what I mean by coercion is police. That's what I mean. I don't mean like the average person saying, "Give me some of your money, or I'm not going to let you work anymore." Yeah, that's coercive in nature. But what I mean is armed officers. So all of the problems that we have today, to a degree, existed back then. But they are magnified today so much. So there's so much more regulation and so much more taxation and so much more police coercion that's backing up the before mentioned articles, that it's very difficult to start a business, to the point where every time I think about starting a business, the first thing I think about is getting a lawyer. And that's ridiculous. That's not freedom. That's not a free market. And when all these people keep spouting about capitalism, it makes me want to laugh, because I don't think we've ever had what I'll call, you know, in a Darwinistic way, I'll call it survival of the fittest. If you literally let people be left to their own devices, they're put in a sink or swim situation, and that's going to temper up the people. The losers are going to be the losers, and they're going to earn their losing, and the winners are going to be the winners, and they're going to earn their winning. It's not going to be done by squiggling words on paper and then paying your fascistic Freemasonic thuggery force to go thug up on the business owners and make sure that nobody can compete. So that's kind of the point I'm making.
I agree, David. There were inspectors, but it was nothing like it is today. Nothing. Or your grandfather probably would have left and moved to Argentina.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the point. We got to go ahead, Flea.
Mr. Rock, I have a solution. If you're going to hire a lawyer, you make sure it's one that you're going to pay enough money to that you want to screw.
The idea of giving a lawyer a damn penny makes me want to puke, you know, for real. The idea of having to pay. I got to deal with.
Tell me about it, man.
I got to deal with.
My ex-wife ran up over $100,000 with her attorney.
I got to deal with architects and engineers a little bit in Florida, and I got to see how corrupt they are. And my dream is to build a sustainable home. And the idea of having to prostrate in front of an architect or an engineer to build something that I know that when I build it, this thing's going to withstand a hurricane. You know what I mean? But I got to go prostrate to somebody that went to college and got a little stupid piece of paper. You know, I actually got – go ahead.
That's because you do quality work. you know, even it's taken so long for me to sit here and build this property down here, but you know what? I do quality work. I make sure that instead of buying cheap nails, I buy, you know, I'm putting up 3/4 inch plywood and stuff, you know, and ripping out the goddamn tendons out of my arm and stuff, you know, but, you know, it's worth it because I want this shit to be here, you know, after I die.
You're bringing up an interesting point. And, okay, we see these McMansions, we see these vehicles, we see all the stuff that you buy at the big box store, and everything today has been thinned out. Okay, if you go look at a home that was built in the 20s, it didn't have plywood. It had tongue and groove. It had actual pine boards that locked into each other and were used as sheeting on the exterior of a house. That tongue and groove is so much – okay, I had a house fire in New York. It was an electrical fire. It started in a soffit above a kitchen. And I'll tell you what, we had tongue and groove for the roof. If we had had plywood, the fire inspector said that whole house would have gone up. Okay? So nowadays, you got it's not even plywood anymore. You got oriented strand board, just little chips of wood that fell off the floor at the mill glued together. Okay? You get that stuff wet, it's compromised. So you see all these $300, $400, $1 million McMansion. It's got vinyl siding. It's got oriented strand board. Everything is fake. The molding is just simple pine. You go back in the day and you had all these beautiful hardwoods that made up these average middle class or lower middle class homes. And nowadays everything is just pine. And if you were to take a look at the board, it's not even one solid run of pine. They're little pieces that are finger grooved and glued to each other. So they've been creating an illusion. They've been stretching that, like the joke with the Jews stretching the penny. They just keep stretching it thinner and thinner and thinner to keep the illusion going. The cars have more and more plastic. The clothing has a lower and lower thread count. If you were to try to go to buy shoes at Walmart and use them, if you were somewhat athletic and use these shoes, they're going to be gone in a month. Okay? And that's why we got to, I'll bring this up again. We need to start thinking about producing things. We need to be able to produce things. We need to be able to pick up the slack for when the Chinese boats stop coming over here. Because if the war ever begins, if a second war for independence begins in the United States, do you think the Chinese are going to be shipping stuff out to us? I highly doubt it. You think our side is going to get funded? I highly doubt it. Go ahead, Flea.
I've seen it, you know. And this is like 20 years ago, that instead of putting plywood on the apartments, you know, these are three stories up in Washington, they would use sheetrock and just put plastic, you know, the plastic, whatever the hell they call it now, you know, over the top. It's like, damn. It's like this, and I'm talking 20 years ago, so I can't even imagine what they're using now.
Well, anytime you get into a situation with an apartment, most of these apartment complexes are not owned by regular old people. Usually they're owned by somebody in New York or New Jersey, if you know what I mean. And the next-door neighbor that I was speaking about that's from Orange County originally, he works for one of those people, and I'll give you a little bit of a clue. Oy vey. Oy vey. Oy gewalt. And he's not paying his employees shit. And I tell you what, maintenance is something that's learned over time. And maintenance is also personal to the structure that you're working on. You know, you're going to gain skills that will work at you. Like, say if you're a maintenance person, you're going to gain skills that are going to go across the board no matter where you're working. But you also build a personal relationship with the property that you're on. You know the people. You know where everything's located. You know the schedules of things. You know the different problems that are going to arise. And that knowledge is so valuable. And over a period of time, if you have a person with a hard work ethic who's able to learn, that person is going to become more valuable every year. And they're going to be able to produce so much more every year. And they're going to be able to prevent things from breaking down, which in the long run saves you money. But these people who are running these places are so greedy that they they would rather fire somebody with all that knowledge than pay them a living wage. And it's disgusting because the reality of it is, mathematically, over the years, eventually this person is going to be worth their weight in salt because they are going to prevent so many problems from going wrong that they're going to save you money and it's going to balance out. But the greed is what needs to be addressed here. Go ahead.
Yeah, you're right. You know, unfortunately, living off the grid here, I've really honed my survival skills, you know, because, you know, you can sit on your ass and wait for things to happen, but when Mother Nature comes at you and you got a foot and a half of snow and the bugs are coming at you, you know, you're going to learn. Either get up off your ass and make shit happen and build things stable, or just die.
Exactly, and that ties in with what I was speaking about before. Get rid of all the taxation, regulation, and coercion, and let's see what survival of the fittest is really like. Let's see how all these Jewish supremacists, let's see how all these Freemasons, let's see what all these pigs, these swine that are just pulling us over for 6-7 miles over the speed limit just to rake us over the coals and pick our back pockets. Let's see how all these people do when their whole system has been turned upside down and gotten rid of. And I think that, like I was saying earlier, I think that's the solution to the homeless problem. There's always going to be hobos. There's always going to be a degree of homeless people. But if you start getting people in the mentality that, oh, if you go to public school and you go these 12 years and you get your degree, everything's going to be fine and dandy. And if you go getting $40,000, $50,000, $100,000 worth of debt in the academia, then you're going to have a job handed to you. And, oh, don't worry, the police will be there to pick up the slack when the looters are coming. And the National Guard will come when the floods happen. And don't worry, the government has it handled for you. And I'm of the opinion that's what's breeding up extremely weak and self-centered and selfish, childish people. That if people were put in a sink or swim situation, they would learn. I'll tell you what, one of the things that I did in my 20s, I just kind of packed up and I just moved to Florida. And I moved in with a friend of mine who turned out not to be that good of a friend. And I had to go through hell. I was put in a situation where I had to sink or swim. And within a few weeks, I was able to find another place, get out of that hellish situation. Just through charm and making friends, I was able to get a good job at a construction company. Granted, I only started out at $10 an hour, but that was 2004, and it was worth more then. And even without getting significant raises, I was able to save money, get an apartment in my own name. And before I eventually went back to New York, but I was only there maybe like 13 months the first time, I went back to New York with $2,000-something freaking dollars in my pocket, making $10 an hour, paying all my own bills, living by myself in a year, okay? And most of the people that I grew up with in high school, they would be lucky to get paid on a Friday and then make it to Monday. Uh-huh. And these same people would turn around and borrow money from their friends every week. So when Friday came along, a big portion of their paycheck was just to pay back the person that they were borrowing the money from. And I told this one person, I said, why can't you just sit home for 2 weeks and not party and then have a 2-week supply of paychecks sitting around? Oh, and then he just went, didn't really give me a good answer and didn't totally acknowledge what I was saying. You have to. If you want to have fruit, you got to suffer a little bit. You got to dig the hole. You got to plant the tree. You got to trim the branches. You got to cover it up when there's a frost. You got to do what it takes. You know, this handing people for nothing shit is never going to work. You're not going to get what you want out of it. And I think I had another article that was alluding to universal basic income, but I can't see where it is in the scroll. So yeah, this idea of a universal basic income needs to be done away with because the reality of it is it's going to do more harm than good. And you got to look at the people that are pushing it. Go ahead.
Well, universal basic income. Well, let me say that it's probably like the EBT cards. You know what I mean? These people on welfare. And once they shut the power off, once you don't have an internet connection and you can't sit there and use your EBT card, I mean, talking about setting people up for You know, they think they're going to get a free ride. No, get up off your ass and do some goddamn work. That's what I'm saying.
Exactly. And here's the thing. This problem is so big, and we can do the best that we can to wake people up. But in the meantime, if you have the ability to get out of the major metropolitan areas, do it, because in many ways, they are a lost cause. And if you're in those major metropolitan areas, I want you to consider building up your skill sets, building up your arms and equipment, and getting ready to evacuate and come out to the country and join up with those of us that are going to be producing food and all of that. You know, we need to start doing and taking a hard look at what our great-great-grandparents were doing, and that's everything: food, clothing, shelter, linens, shoemaking, the whole gambit. You could take tires and make shoes out of it, and that's what the poor people in Mexico have to do who are in the poorer areas of that country. They're making their shoes out of tires. I was talking about it with my next-door neighbor. He was saying, yeah, they're actually good shoes, and they last forever, and the sandals last forever. So we need to start looking around. We need to start thinking outside of the box. If all we ever do is just sit there and complain about what we're seeing in the media, we're not going to be ready for what's coming. And, you know, I mean, we got to pull back. We have allowed ourselves to become dependent on this system. We have allowed ourselves to be dependent on foreign slave goods that are being brought over here, which, folks, is another illusion, because in many ways those foreign slaves goods are being subsidized, and the tariff system is completely unfair. Go ahead.
Well, you think we're still here and alive because our grandparents and their grandparents were lazy?
No. And you don't have to kill yourself. You don't have to, you know, but there's a balance to everything. Life is all about balance. You work too much and you're going to die too young. But if you don't work at all, you're also going to die too young. I mean, I remember in this one city or one township outside of New York, seeing this 85-year-old man out there with his son and his grandson putting up a pole barn in the middle of the winter, stepping through the muck and the mire. And that's because that man just never stopped. And with that said, we've reached the end of the hour. I appreciate our callers. I appreciate all our listeners. And join us again tomorrow for Oy Vey Friday, ladies and gentlemen.